They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters. Psalm 107, verse 23. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining this week, and welcome to all in. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you will enjoy, and that you'll take advantage of our backlog of episodes. And if you are a returning listener, as always, thank you so, so much. Please rate, like, subscribe, download, all that kind of stuff to help the show grow and get people notified that it exists, I guess, for lack of a better term. This week, we will be finishing up our discussion about Southern East Asia between 6 and 4,000 BC. And we're going to set the stage after, also for our next couple of episodes taking place. But let's go ahead and dive into it. I didn't have too much feedback other than just, you know, thumbs up and likes and that kind of stuff. So no specific questions to get into. Now, last week, we went over some genetic and linguistic topics. But there is one group that in the next few seasons that are going to be very important for this region and Southeast Asia and other parts of the world that I have not talked about. These are known as the Austronesian. Now, this term started as a linguistic term, but has been used by others. It's begun to be used by others in other disciplines, geneticists, archaeologists, historians, and various other academics of all stripes. And it's used to describe a group of people living on the island of Taiwan, and then that proceeded to migrate off the island and spread far and wide into Southern East Asia, Southeast Asia, both mainland and maritime, Micronesia, Melanesia, Polynesia, and even into Madagascar. Now, I'm going to go ahead and say that this is not a universally accepted theory. There are some who think that they may have emerged somewhere else in the greater maritime Southeast Asia, like Papua New Guinea, or somewhere along maybe Melanesia or Micronesia, and then either they spread out from there, or then they landed in Taiwan, and then spread out from Taiwan in one of their various waves of migrations. There are also those that argue that the language just spread through close contacts, like trade, and evolved in an area, and then spread when those locals spread or traded with other peoples. Then there are those that say that the whole idea of an Austronesian group as a whole just doesn't exist. Trying to think of some of the arguments I read in that vein. But they would basically say it's just not real because, the reasons never make sense to me. They say things like, no one ever migrated that far in the past, or building the necessary boats for that type of travel was too hard, or that it's a kind of colonialism and that can exist in non-capitalist societies. Now, that last one's an extreme example and was used by someone who I'm not sure if they were being serious or not. And that's an extreme example. And I'm not really going to give too much credence to that theory. I think the other two, you know, those are more reasonable, you know, if you take those people's research and you read it, you know, they have solid points. Now, all that being said, most scholars support the out of Taiwan theory because it has the most evidence of whatever variety of evidence you would like to peruse. Archaeological, genetic, linguistic, what have you. However, to merely say that the Austronesian people originated from Taiwan is really just too simplistic to just state. It's important to keep in mind that there is no centralized, organized effort by any single political entity or ethnic group on the island that is directing these migrations. And they're not explicitly done as a means of expansion or conquest. And it's not a quick process. It's taking place over hundreds and thousands of years. Now, there are also places where the Austronesians may have landed and visited and not stayed, where they did merely influence or trade or converse with locals or maybe raided locals. Piracy may have been a thing. We know from later historical periods that if not Taiwan directly, some of the islands surrounding Taiwan were known as pirate havens. But that's, again, that's far in the future. Hold on, we got someone just speeding down the highway. I hope you guys didn't catch that. But all of that said, for this season, that is the apparent extent of influence they would have had on what, again, is now southern China and Southeast Asia, is just the probable influence or trade interactions. It's not any kind of expansion effort, at least not that we have evidence of. But before we dive into that, I want to talk about the island of Taiwan, a little bit about its geography, etymology, and the people who live on it today, and how you might want to categorize them. Now, in Western parlance, the island of Taiwan was, for most of Western European knowledge of the island, known as Formosa. And this is from the Portuguese. I believe it's a combination of Formosus and the word forma, which is Formosus is beautiful, handsome, well-shaped, and forma is, of course, just form or shape. So the Portuguese called it Formosa for like the beautiful island. And that was used for most of the period that the Europeans and by extension Americans had been interacting with the island until after, I think, World War II, when it was more regularly referred to as Taiwan, which is what it was referred to in by the Chinese, and that was one of the names the Chinese used, depending on what they're referring to. If they refer to the island as a whole, it would sometimes be referred to as Zhaodongdao, which is like Little Eastern Island. Then also it would sometimes be referred to as Dahuiguo, which was the country of Dahui, which is... they believe it's a corruption of the Taiyuan, which was a tribe that lived on kind of a little islet near modern Tainan, which is a settlement on southern Taiwan. It's like a prefectural capital there. Now, those are names that were used towards kind of the fairly close to when the Europeans started to show up on the island. Those terms were in use. Earlier Chinese records refer to different places that are believed to be Taiwan or different peoples living on the island of Taiwan. It's like, different polities arise and fall, and, when traders get there and they ask, where are we? They'll give them different answers if they're not in different places. And of course, at different times, a different state could be in control. The earliest records I think we have written down wise of the Chinese visiting Taiwan, I think there is some evidence that that they were visiting there is around the 230s AD. Now, they've obviously been visiting there much longer, but that's the first written record of a centralized government, explicitly authorized embassy or trade delegation. It's during the Three Kingdoms period of China, I believe. Now, those are the ones I'm familiar with. There could be older ones, but those are ones that I know are probably the oldest off the top of my head. And that's in the Imperial Chinese period, We'll get there much later. We've got other ancient Chinese stuff to talk about, including this season. The island itself is extremely mountainous, to put it lightly. I think most of the eastern portion of the island is very mountainous, and then you've got like a western kind of plain where 90% of the population lives today. But like the plain is like a third of the island, and the eastern two-thirds are, you know, very forested, very mountainous. I think there is like a little strip of plain like on that eastern end where you do have some settlement, but again, most of it is on the west coast of the island. And you know, that is where you will, of course, see most people living these days. But that's also been a dividing line historically between the indigenous Taiwanese peoples. Now, some of this is kind of hard to really nail down because the island has been occupied by foreigners numerous periods. And I say foreigners when I say Chinese, that includes, you know, the people of Chinese descent as well. Not to say they don't have a right to live there, and I'm not saying that. But in terms of the Aboriginal population, they make up, I believe, 600,000 or so make up of the Aboriginal population. I think it's around 600,000. And that is just Aboriginal people living in the mountains. You also had Aboriginal people who were living in the plains areas. However, it's hard to tell in some cases who is descended from the Aboriginal peoples living in the plains, because they've been so thoroughly cyanized, or they've intermarried as well. So it's kind of hard to say exactly what percentage of the population is indigenous Taiwanese. Now, there are ways to tell. Obviously, you can do genetic testing and things like that, but it's not necessarily something that, we have to dive into right now on the podcast, because, again, a lot of it is going to come up later. But essentially, the traditional, breakdown of the indigenous peoples living on the island, you had two groups. You had the mountain people and you had the people of the plains. Now, in our records that we have today, you can break them down into further subgroups, each with their own language or dialect of one of those languages. But before I do kind of go into a little bit more detail, I did want to say, when I say sinicized, that's not necessarily that they were all sinicized by the Han. There have been other Chinese languages that have been imported into the island. Hokkien, which is like a version of Min Chinese. And then you also have Hakka, which is a version of, which is also a version of Chinese. I forget if Hakka is its own dialect or if it's a different branch altogether. But both Hokkien and Hakka have Taiwanese varieties, which should tell you that they've been spoken on the islands for a decent period. But I don't think the Chinese really started to colonize the islands until around the Ming Dynasty, maybe a little bit earlier than that. Now, again, they've been visiting for far longer and trading, but I don't think they really started to show up in real numbers until later periods. You have the mountainous indigenous peoples, and you have the plains indigenous peoples. In Chinese, it's the Ping Puzu, which are the plains people, and you have the Gao Shun Zu, which are the mountain indigenous people. And, then again, you have the Hokkien and the Hakka versions of those names. It's Kosoa Chok for Hokkien, Pepo Chok for Hokkien, and for Hakka, you have the Kosanchuk and Finfushuk. And the Japanese had this same distinction. They had the Takasago-zoku and the Heihozoku. The Taiwanese government today recognizes, I believe, 16 ethnic groups for the mountainous indigenous peoples. The plains, again, it's really hard to say, but it is kind of hard to, you know, nailed down, but they have I think it's around 15. They have around 18 listed groups, though again, they don't necessarily get the same kind of recognition. And some of them may just be kind of grouped in with others. There's more debate on the plains indigenous cultures. But this kind of variety in these groups does lend credence. This is one of those linguistic pieces of evidence I talked about. Again, linguists tend to agree that the place where you see more divergences in the language is somewhere that language has been longer. And you know, Taiwan's a decent-sized island, but the fact that they have all these different dialects or branches of the same language tends to hint that these languages have existed there longer than anywhere else. Now, you could also argue that just because the island's so big, it has more places for these various places or these various languages to grow. And maybe if it were a smaller island, they wouldn't have had the capability to have this type of divergence. But again, that's kind of the linguistic argument for Taiwan being the home of the Austronesian language. Or the original home of the Austronesian language, excuse me. And all of these various ethnic groups that are recognized, however 30-odd, many of them there may or may not be. There are, I believe, 9 or 10 different Austronesian languages spoken on the island today. These fall into East Formosian, Western Plains, Northwest Formosian, Bunan, Suohic, Rukai, Puyuma, Paiwan, and Malayo-Polynesian. Though that last one is a little bit debated. Some people think that that belongs in Eastern Formosian, and that's only spoken on a small island kind of to the south east of Taiwan. And, you know, that's one of those ones where, like, maybe, you know, someone from Malaya came up and first settled there. But again, most people don't buy that hypothesis. That's just one of the points that, you know, people kind of argue that maybe Austronesian did not emerge in Taiwan. Now, I'm gonna try and list these. Apologies to any speakers of these languages if I butcher it. I probably will. But in the mountainous indigenous group, you have the Pangka Amis, the Tayal, the Bunan, the Kana Kanavu, Kabalan, the Kalisian, the Pinu Yumayan, Drake, La Alu, Sai Siat, Sakizaya, the Siddiq, the Truku, the Thao, the Ko, and the Tao. And then the plains indigenous groups that you have that are recognized are the Arakun, the Babuza, the Basay, the Hoanya, the Kaxabu, the Ketagalan, Kulan, the Lula, the Liulong, the Makatao, the Papora, the Paza, the Kwakwat, Seraya, Taivoan, Taukas, Favorlong, and the Trobia Wan. And again, I do so apologize if I butchered those. Now, it's important to realize that, yeah, these groups probably do not all exist as a separate ethnicity or, you know, tribal group at this period of time. But, you know, you have precursors I'm going to try and do some research on them for future seasons to see maybe which groups are more closely related to each other. But you can kind of, you can see a linguistic map of how it's broken down. I think the big one I saw for a lot of the plains are the Western Plains. You have the Babuza, the Hoiana, the Thao, and there are a couple of others there, but the map is very small, and I can't read because it's in multiple languages, and they're all kind of stacked on each other, so I don't want to mix them up too much. But at this period, they're still practicing hunting and gathering. They do have pottery on the island, I think, at this period, though that probably shows up kind of towards the end of this season. But they are sailing, at the very least, by 5000 BC. They are making trips off the island. They're probably doing it well before that. And, you know, reaching the coast on the other side of the Taiwan Strait. Remember, when people first got to Taiwan, it was connected via land bridge. But the water levels have been steadily rising, as we talked about in other places for this season. And that's probably wiped out a few of the earlier settlements on Taiwan. They're probably underwater. So unfortunately, we can't, you know, find those. Now, there have also been some that were damaged during construction of, you know, various places on the island, either in the modern day or during World War II or in the run-up to World War II also. Remember, the Japanese were on the island for a number of years, and they did a lot of construction. They fortified the island and that kind of thing. Not to mention, of course, the Europeans who were there before then. I think the Dutch had a good chunk of Formosa for a number of years as well. And, you know, any or all of those Europeans could have, like, dug up stuff and not realize what they were doing at the time. Now, the trips to China during this period would have probably just been, like, extended maybe hunting or fishing voyages, nothing too substantial. And again, they probably partook in some level of trade, possibly raiding as well. But there is evidence of them going much further than that. There has been evidence on the island of Luzon in the Philippines, where there is, you know, high similarities between certain items found on Taiwan at the time and Luzon, dating to about 5000 BC. So, you know, they could have gone much further. Now, how regularly these trips were, we don't really know. And it doesn't appear that that site in Luzon was occupied for a super long time. And it may not have even been the Austronesian people who did it. They could have gotten to a much closer island, and then it was spread further by local inhabitants, which, yeah, that's certainly possible. But right around 4000 BC or so, you see agriculture get to the island. This is where you get to the full Neolithic time frame for Taiwan. And this is going to be a culture we'll talk about next season in detail. And this is known as the Dapen Kang culture. And it spread on Taiwan, but there's also evidence that they had some of the coastal islands around what is now China, Kinmen Island, as well as a couple of others. But yeah, that's kind of what we have for this season for the Austronesian people. And, you know, there is evidence, again, that they're there during this period at numerous places, but it's not, you know, very in-depth. And there is always the case that, you know, this could just be a, early settlers from Taiwan arriving and, you know, getting dispersed into the local populations that were already living there. There's no clear shot that they went back to Taiwan. So these could have been early waves of migrations that just didn't get anywhere, or, you know, again, possible trading or fishing voyages. So that's kind of what I have for Taiwan for this season. Now, I'm kind of going to lay out what's going to be the next episode or two for East Asia, possibly three, actually, now that I look at it. So there are going to be a number of Neolithic cultures in the rest of East Asia / China, though some kind of maybe in Mongolia as well. And they are, I'm going to try to do them chronologically. So we're going to be jumping around a little bit, but these are going to include things like the Holi culture, which is around the Shandong part of eastern China. It's a peninsula. Then we also have the the Shandong Peninsula is the big part of it, but the whole province is not just the peninsula. Then you also have Zhonglonghua culture, which is in Mongolia, and I talked a little bit about the Holi and the Zhonglonghua, but we'll also have the Xishan culture and the Dadiwan. So we're going to be jumping around a lot, and I'm going to try and do it in a mix of geography and chronologically, but we're essentially going to be jumping between the two big rivers, the Yellow River and the Yangtze River. And there are a number of Neolithic cultures we're going to talk about. It's even more than what we talked about in the Mesopotamia region. I think there's around 13 or 14 Neolithic cultures we're going to have to talk about. And some of them will, you know, last past this season. I know the Daiji culture and the Yang Shao culture all kind of come up during this period, and they go until 3000. And those are just a couple of them. There's a couple of more that will come up, and we'll talk about their early development and how they will continue for quite a while. Some of these are very long lasting cultures. Some over, you know, some 2000 years, some around 1500, give or take. So it's going to be a lot to go over. So I'm thinking three episodes, maybe four, depending on how tightly I can kind of tie them all together. I'm not trying to short any of them, but obviously some of the resources are not fully translated, or they're only partially translated, I should say. And I'm not very good at reading Chinese. Just keep that in mind. So we've got a lot to go over for the next few episodes. And after that, we'll cover the rest of East Asia, Korea, Mongolia, that kind of region. And, of course, Japan, too. Kind of a lot to go over, but it will be, I think, worth it. I'm thinking if I'm going to tie in some of the Chinese myths about the period. Obviously, you know, when you get to classical China, they have their own history of the region that kind of precedes what we would consider classical Chinese civilization. But how much that has to do with, you know, what's happening at this period, it's hard to say. I do think there is some overlap to go over. China's got a very rich shamanistic tradition that kind of gets subsumed by later, I wouldn't say organized religions per se, but things like Taoism, Confucianism. They kind of both do a really good job of like integrating several local traditions and folk traditions that are probably extremely long-lasting. And we're going to talk a lot about the issues with the environment that they're having to deal with, floods, earthquakes. These are going to be big topics when it comes to China. And that's also something that happens on Taiwan. I didn't go into this, but Taiwan is right on the fault line, so they do have a problem with earthquakes. There are volcanoes, I believe, still active. Taiwan itself. seas around there. But it's a very geologically active region. And you know, those pose challenges to all these cultures, especially the ones along the river. That's kind of what we have to look forward to for the next couple of weeks. So I hope you all continue to join me and listen to me talk and ramble about it all. Yeah, if you guys have any questions or comments, feedback, anything like that, please let me know. I would be happy to hear from you. You can reach me via email at war@revpod.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter/X. You can comment on YouTube videos. I stream there live most days during the week and sometimes on the weekends. Welcome to Chop. Stop and chat. Say hey. I always enjoy listeners coming in for that. But yeah. So I will see everyone next time. I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you hear this. And I will see you all next time. Peace.